Well, you may not know this, but when I was in high school, I had a bit of an alter ego. His name was Manuel, and Manuel was my Spanish name. I took Spanish for 7 years in high school. I remember about this much of it, 7 years of investment. I can say hello, I can count, I know some of the months. It all culminated in a Spanish cooking class where everything was in Spanish, and somehow I passed. And reading the Spanish wasn't the hard part, but actually cooking the food, that was difficult, you know. And sampling it afterwards was very dangerous. But one of the things I remember most about Spanish class is when we finished up a lesson, our teacher, Senora Malora, would play a review game. And the review game was kind of like the Family Feud. You know how Family Feud starts out where two people come up and they got to hit the buzzer first and answer it? And Manuel, my alter ego, was renowned in Exeter High School as never losing a Spanish showdown. And so it was a lot of pressure towards the end. But this review time, and what we found is that the review and kind of doing it in this different format really helped us to understand things. So I tell all of those goofy stories to let you know that today, as we finish up Margin, it's going to be a bit of a review. We're going to talk about the things we've already talked about, but I'm going to introduce a tool to you that I hope is going to cement this stuff into your reality. So a little bit later on, we'll pass something out for you. But as we engage in this, the question I want you to ask yourself this morning, or maybe the question that God is desiring me to ask of you this morning, is what are you going to do about everything we've talked about? What are you going to do about it? It's great to hear it. It makes a lot of sense. Boy, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could live like that. But what are you going to do about it? James chapter 1, verse 22 to 25. You've probably heard this before. This is what James writes in the inspiration of the Spirit. Do not merely listen to the word, and by so doing deceive yourselves. You must do what it says. Do not merely listen to the word and by so doing deceive yourselves. You must actually do what it says. And so I ask you the question again, what are you going to do on the basis of everything we've talked about? Percentages say that in a church our size, a very small portion of people are going to do anything about it. Most people hear things and do nothing about it. And I'm not saying that as a judgment on you. I'm saying that as a reflection on my own life, you know? It's how we are. We like to hear things, but it's very difficult to try to put them into practice. James is careful to tell us, if you don't act on what you've heard, then you're deceiving yourself. You're deceiving yourself as if you've actually learned something important. Now, of course, we're working on the presupposition here, the assumption that you've resonated with what we've talked about. This is obviously not a force-feeding reality. But I think there are two ways in Christian faith that we often are simply listeners. We're just listeners, and by so doing, we deceive ourselves. The first is we're really good at hearing, but it stops there. We resonate with stuff. It's not like we just tune the pastor out or tune the scriptures out when we're reading it. It resonates with us, and we hear something, and it's meaningful. But usually it stops right there. Have you ever had that? You ever had a time alone where you're reading the scriptures, and the Spirit speaks to you powerfully about something, and then you just go on living your day, you know? And it's just this wonderful moment of insight, and yet it never becomes a reality in the practical realms of your life. I think that many of us, that's how we function on Sunday mornings. I think we're engaged. I think we care. I think we think we're hearing from God and doing these things, but usually it never gets any further. And what James would say to us then is that we're deceiving ourselves. We really haven't learned anything because we're choosing to just keep on living the way we've always lived. Or maybe this is a better description of us. Sometimes we have really good intentions, right? We don't just hear, but we add really good intentions to that, but we really struggle on follow through, right? We hear these things, and I'm gonna do this. And as soon as I get time, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to work on some of these things, I'm going to pray through this, I'm going to figure this out. But you know, as I know, that time never comes. The tyranny of the urgent takes over, and good intentions never get us where we intended to go. When Rachel and I were dating, I had gone on this, the last week, or the week that school ended, college ended, I had a one-week class that went away on this crazy hike through the woods. And at the end of it, I came home and I went and I hung out with Rachel at her parents' house, at her family's house. And we hadn't seen each other in a while, and I was going home for the summer. And so we were all there having a good time, and it was getting later, and I kept postponing leaving. And finally, at like 1 in the morning, I left. And I'm coming back from this week of sleeping in a sleeping bag on mountains, getting poured on, doing all kinds of crazy things, being manipulated by a strange teacher who was doing sociological experiments on us, I believe. Seeing how long we could withstand this and not kill each other, you know. And then hanging out with Rachel and then leaving. And I made it all the way to the edge of Philadelphia. I crossed the Ben Franklin Bridge. I made it through the Vine Street Expressway at 1 o'clock in the morning. That's a quick ride. And I got on the Schuylkill Expressway. And then I don't remember what happened, right? I ended up in some community in the main line, parked in front of someone's house, fast asleep. I have no idea. I swear I must have been spared somehow. God picked my car off the Schuylkill Expressway and just dumped me in Malvern or somewhere. I don't know where it was. I woke up and I had this moment of like, oh my goodness, how did I end up here? Is that sometimes like our spiritual lives? We start off on the path, we know where we're headed, but we're not consistent in the follow-through, and we end up asleep in some mainline town, you know? What I want to suggest to you is the wisdom of James here is so prudent, so important, so on the nose. You've got to do it now. Otherwise, it won't work. See, so many Christians, in our world especially, have taken their spiritual lives and have put them on autopilot. And we wonder why we end up where we end up. You know? Here's what I want you to know. If you are not being formed intentionally by the gospel, then you are being formed intentionally by the world. All right? Don't just think because you're not being intentional about being formed in the gospel that you're just in a holding pattern. You're actually choosing to be formed by the world. We've got to be vigorously intent in our pursuit of Jesus. Vigorously intent. And for so many of us, we wonder where the passion has gone, why we've ended up where we've ended up, and the truth is because we've pushed autopilot on our spiritual lives and just kept doing what we're doing and hoping it gets us through to the end because it got us off to a good start. But James says you've got to be a doer. Listen to what he says as he continues here. Verse 23, anyone who listens to the world but does not do what it says is like someone who looks at his face in the mirror. Anyone who listens to the word, excuse me, not world, and does not do what it says is someone who looks at his face in the mirror and after looking at himself immediately forgets what he looks like. Now, can you imagine? I don't know what you look like when you wake up in the morning. You know, you don't know what I look like, you know, and probably better we don't even try to figure out what we look like in the morning. But I know this for most of you. If you take a look in the mirror and you get a picture of something that is not how you want it to look, chances are you're taking care of it before you step out, right? Like my kids wouldn't do that. My kids get out of the shower and don't comb their hair and come down with hoods up and I, you know, Rach is teaching and I'm got to comb their hair and make sure it looks good and it's stressful for me. And so then I get them in the bathroom and I'm using combs and stuff. And sometimes Jackson tries to be proactive. He gets like 8 pounds of gel and puts it through his hair and it's sticking up like alfalfa. And then I got to wash his head in the sink. It's crazy. That was very therapeutic for me. Thank you for listening to that. But we're not like that. Like we look in the mirror and we think, oh, I should do something here. I mean, you don't have to make yourself perfect, but you know maybe fixing things up is good, but But James says to us that people who just hear and don't do are like people who look in the mirror and then instantly forget what they look like and go out, you know? And no self-respecting person would do that. In the same way, no self-respecting Christian should do that in their spiritual lives, right? And yet we constantly live like this. Verse 25, but whoever looks intently into the perfect law, the gospel, that gives freedom and continues in it, not forgetting what they have heard, but actually doing it, they will be blessed in what they do. Do you hear this? The way that you don't forget the gospel is that you actually apply it to your lives. You don't hear more people talking about it. You don't read more books about it. You actually start to apply it to your life. And what you will find out is not only do you not forget it, not only is it changing your life, but it is opening your life in unbelievable ways of freedom and is actually spurring you on to want more of it. Why do we not desire more spiritual growth in our life? Because we're not experiencing very much of it right now. We don't know the transformational reality, the liberating force of the gospel. We are gazing in the mirror and immediately forgetting what we look like. And so we've had all of these weeks on margin. And I ask the question, are we simply going to be hearers or are we going to be doers? Are we simply going to have heard this stuff about why living in the crazy rat race of life is killing us? Or are we going to actually make effort to try to build margin into our life for the right things? This morning, I want to introduce you to a tool that I think can be so helpful. In fact, it's been used for thousands of years. Well, for 2,000 years. That's thousands, right? To be helpful to people just like you and I. It's called the rule of life. The rule of life. And at first glance, that word, that phrase sounds so harsh, doesn't it? I hate rules. The minute someone starts talking about rules is the minute I start figuring out how to get around them. Right? That's what we do. You build a fence, I design my way over it, or through it, or under it. And I know a lot of you are like me. We don't like rules. We don't like to be built in. The Greek word that is translated rule has a very different connotation. It's actually not harsh. It actually is used of what we would call a modern-day trellis. It's a structure so that a grapevine could grow upward and outward and not rot on the ground, thereby bearing much fruit. So when the church fathers talk about creating a rule of life, this is what they're talking about. How do you build a structure into your life that allows your spiritual life to grow upward and outward so that you can bear much fruit and not just rot on the ground? On autopilot. In the late 200s, the 3rd century, the church was huge in northern Africa, especially in Egypt, Algeria, Libya, those places. And as the church grew, same way it happens in our world, the church begins to look a lot more like the world, right? It just happens. Anything that sits around begins to rust and tarnish. And so there was a man named Anthony who was hearing a sermon preached a sermon that was talking about how to have a deeper spiritual life, probably based on the rich young ruler. It talked a lot about selling your possessions and going out, giving everything to the poor. And he decided he was going to follow it literally. I'm not suggesting you've got to do that, right? But this is how God moved in the heart of Anthony. He sold everything that he had, seemed to be a pretty wealthy guy. He gave tons of it to the poor. He left enough for his sister so she'd be well off. And he moved into the desert. He was the first of what would become called the Desert Fathers. Because he started a trend. People started doing this because they didn't want their world, their life, their structure to be formed by the world. They wanted to be centered on God. As more and more people went out there, they began to live in communities. It's the start of monasticism. And they began to write what they called rules of life, systems and structures that governed their existence so that they would be careful to make sure that everything was centered on Jesus, not just taking it as it comes. after reading a story about Anthony of the Desert, Anthony the Great, a man named Augustine heard a small voice that said to him, "Tole lege." Latin means come and read. And so he opened the Bibles and he opened it right to the book of Romans. And Augustine was converted. And Augustine is a father who has shaped so much of what we believe today. He has sort of structured it and helped us to understand it in succinct ways. Augustine then thereafter himself wrote a rule of life. In the late 400s, there was a man named Benedict, a wealthy man, lived in the city of Rome, and he looked around him at the church and the world, and he was just overwhelmed by how awful life was, how pagan, how corrupt. And so he sold everything and he moved to a cave. And for 3 years, he lived out there, and people started following him because they were just overwhelmed by the way the world had shaped their life. And Benedict wrote the most famous of all rules of life. Perhaps you've heard of it before. It's called the Rule of Saint Benedict. And it's still used in some communities to this day. The Pope before Pope Francis named himself Pope Benedict because in many ways Benedict is recognized as someone who saved Christianity in his day all throughout Europe. What is true of all of these people is that they were interested in forming a life centered on Jesus in a very intentional way. What I am not suggesting this morning is that we all become nuns and monks, right? That's a bit extreme. I'm not certain exactly what was going on there, but their situations, it rose up on them that way. What I am suggesting to you is that we must respond to the gospel in an intentional way to order our lives on Jesus. Otherwise, it won't happen. And I want to suggest to you in the remaining moments we have together that the rule of life is a fantastic tool to make this happen. In fact, all of you have rules of life already. You haven't written them down, but if I pressed you on them and asked you the right questions, you would tell me what your rule of life is, what your rhythms of life are, how you pursue God, how you pursue others, what your work consists of, so forth and so on. We've sort of softened the word here at Hope. We call it rhythm of life. That way we don't have to explain rules because it kind of goes against what we talk about. How do we go about creating a rhythm of life? Here's three purposes I want to give to you, right? Four purposes perhaps. The first is the rhythm of life, the purpose of the rhythm of life is to center yourself on Jesus. Second is it's meant to be intentional. No more autopilot for our lives. No more let's just get through to Sunday and hear what the pastor has to say. Too much of modern-day Christian spirituality is living vicariously through someone else, and it has to stop. You do not need to live my spirituality, and I ought not to live yours. It is the danger of modern-day Christianity that people who are hearing and listening and reading are living through pastors and writers and speakers rather than developing their own desire to follow Jesus. Listen, I don't need you to know more about the gospel. I need you to love the gospel. And it won't happen unless you develop it for yourself. Intentional. Doers, not listeners. The third purpose of rules of life is it builds a framework for freedom. We need a trellis to grow upward and outward. We think that having no structure is going to lead to this great freedom, and it leads to death. We need a system and a structure that is stretching to us, but that is not overwhelming, that allows freedom to function within. And then here's the last thing, and I think this is so true. We sort of hit on this when we talked about Sabbath. I think that if you develop a rhythm of life for you, for your family, that it will be an unbelievably effective prophetic witness to the watching world, who is so caught up in life and the world, they're desperate for another way, but they don't know how. They've heard the church talk for a long time, and no one does anything, and so it really doesn't look compelling. But what if we actually started to live in a way? Why was it that what Anthony did was so compelling? Why was it that what Augustine did was so compelling? Why was it that what Benedict was so compelling? Because they had the audacity to say that I will not let my life be defined by this world, but I will do whatever it takes to make sure my life is defined by Christ and Him alone. This is what we're talking about when we talk about this. So, Tony's got a bunch of worksheets, if you were. Sounds horrible, right? I know. It's going to look like this. This is a tool for you. He's going to pass them out. You can be filling this in as we talk through the rest of the time. This is our review, right? We're getting ready for a big test. There is a test. It's called life, right? And so let's review together. And this is, you know, if you're utilitarian like me, if you desire to build a rhythm of life and you're utilitarian like me, you'll go no farther than this. If you're creative and beautiful, this will just be step one into creating something that looks beautiful for you. A rhythm of life simply takes everything we've talked about and puts it down in a form of commitment. Takes everything we've talked about and puts it down in a form of commitment. So if you were with us the first week when we gathered in this series on margins, we talked about who are you going to let tell your story? Who are you going to let tell your story? The world tells your story like this. It says, what can you do for me? And your response is, what do you want from me? And we live like this constantly. I've got to do this for my work. I've got to do this for my family. I've got to progress. But God tells your story simply by saying that you are loved. Not because of what you can produce. Not because of how you can progress. You are loved. Entering into a rhythm of life, and this is personal for you, however you want to do it, is simply you saying, I am not going to simply hear that message, I'm going to act on it. I'm not just going to simply propositionally believe that God loves me, I'm going to start ordering my life as if I really believe it's true. Right? This is radical. No one does this kind of stuff. We do that on Sunday for a couple of hours, and then we just go back to living our life of progress and production. You remember we said there's a difference between the rich young ruler and the little children. The rich young ruler, when he's asking Jesus, what do I have to do to get to the kingdom, is living according to the story of the world, right? What do I have to do? What do I have to do? What do I have to produce? God, I want you to love me, but what do I have to do to earn your affection? What do I have to do? Do I have to, how much spiritual, how much prayer time, how much this? What do I have to do to be seen as valuable? And Jesus says, you got to be like the little kids who just come into my arms. They know they're loved, and that's all that matters. Your willingness to put up your hands in the form of a rule of life is a lot like entering the kingdom like little kids. And so at the top of this, it says a personal rhythm of life. My invitation to allow God to tell my story. The second week, we talked about choices and how this world is filled with choices. I read an interesting article a couple of months ago that said some of the most productive and brilliant people wear the same thing every day. Have you ever seen those things before? They talked about Einstein, who wore the same suit all the time, Steve Jobs, who wears that crazy black turtleneck all the time. But they say the elimination of unnecessary choices allows people to focus on the things that are the most important. And so rather than stand in front of your closet and figure out what should I wear today, they already know. And they go. We talked about choices like this. The world says you should answer choices by asking yourself the question, can I do this? Something is put before you, you should say, can I do it? And we say that when we tell our stories, we ask ourselves the question, what will happen to me if I don't do this? Right? The boss says, I need you to stay later. The world wants you to answer that by saying, do I have the ability to do this? you are immediately thinking, what happens if I say no to this? What are the ramifications? But here are the two questions that Scripture raised up for us in Ephesians and through the story of Martha and Mary. The real questions we ought to be asking ourselves are, is it wise? Is it wise to do this? And secondly, is it the best use of my time? Is it wise and is it the best? If you remember in Ephesians, the concept of talking about is it wise, Paul says, listen, the days are evil, so be careful in the choices you make. Choose with wisdom. You must be wise. And what he says in there, know what God's will is so that you can make wise decisions. We talked about that. We said that God's will, straightforward, simple. It's not this big bullseye that you're looking for. I'm coming up to graduation from Lehigh. I need to know what I'm supposed to do. God, show me, show me, show me, show me. Less that, more, hey, whatever you do, you ought to glorify God. This is the will of God. So in that box right there, my divine purpose is to glorify God. That's what you were made to do. That's what you were designed to do. And you say, well, that's so abstract. What do I even do? How do I even do that? Jesus, in his prayer, right before his crucifixion, said this, Father, I have brought you glory. How? By accomplishing the work you have given me to do. You glorify God by accomplishing the work he has given you to do. What is the work he's given you to do? Matthew chapter 28, verse 18 to 20. Right? Be my disciples and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, teaching them to obey everything that I've commanded you. Lo, I'm with you always to the ends of the earth. This is universal. It is not different for anyone. All of us, our divine purpose is to glorify God by making disciples. Glorify God by making disciples. But each of us has a unique calling, right? We're all meant to do this, but in our own unique way. How you're shaped, the passions that God has given you, who he surrounded you with, where he's placed you. And so you need to begin asking yourself, how has God uniquely equipped me to glorify him by making disciples? Maybe you're a teacher. Maybe it's through being a mom or a dad. Maybe it's through your creativity. When you answer those two things and are very clear on them and have them in your rhythm or rule of life, when decisions and choices are put in front of you, you can honestly ask the question, is this wise? Let me give you an example. Your divine purpose is to glorify God by making disciples. Your unique calling in this particular season of life is you are a stay-at-home mom and you are discipling your children. That is the most prominent thing you're doing right now, right? And your kid wants to sign up for tackle football. And he's also signed up for swimming, and he wants to do karate, and he's doing the other thing. And so you begin asking yourself the questions, not, hey, well, can we do this? Do we have enough money? Do we have time to do this? Does it make sense? Should we do this? Not, what if I don't? Well, what if I tell my kid no to something? How is he going to react to me? Is he going to hate me? Is he going to go to counseling for 10 years because I wasn't doing to him all that he needed me to do, you know? No, my divine purpose is to glorify God by making disciples. My unique calling in this particular season of life is to disciple my kids. I'm home with them. That's a specific thing that God has given to me. And so I'm going to say, does signing them up for this take away or add to what God has called me to do? Does it make sense? And then you can begin saying to yourself, is it wise? And secondly, is it the best? We said three things are the best. Remember Martha, she missed out on the best things because she was focused on the tasks. We said the best things are knowing God. She missed out on spending time with Jesus. Being in relationship with others. She missed out on being with everyone at the table because she was focused on tasks. And then rest for yourself. She missed out on rest for herself because she was so given to tasks. What are the best things and how do we choose them? There's four boxes underneath that you need to begin planning how you're going to do this. Listen, this is a framework for freedom, right? This is not a scorecard You don't look at all at this next week and figure out all the ways in which you have failed. That's not the gospel. Here's how I'm going to try to be practical. And guess what? You're going to have to keep playing with it and figuring it out and changing things. It's not a final document. But what would it mean for you to not be satisfied with knowing about God, but be fully given to knowing God himself? In John chapter 10, verse 10, Jesus said, "The liar, he comes to steal, kill, and destroy, but I come that you might have life, and life to the fullest." The world is attempting to steal, kill, and destroy your life. But Jesus comes not to give you a full life, but to give you life to the fullest. Now, what is this life that Jesus talks about? What does it mean? Well, in John chapter 17, this is what Jesus says. "Now, this is eternal life, that you may know God and Jesus Christ, whom he has sent." Life is knowing God, right? The full life is being in dynamic relationship with God, not in filling your life with activities. You might remember the story of Jesus from Mark chapter 1. Jesus has been engaged in a full day of ministry, teaching in the synagogues, healing half a town, right? It leads us to believe people are still lined up. It's into the middle of the night, and it says early the next morning he went away to be with God. Why? Because he had a rhythm of life. He said, "This is what I do. I'm not going to be apart from this." Listen, there's a difference between having a set 30-minute devotional time and being committed to knowing God. A 30-minute devotional time is great. I'm not telling you to get rid of it. It's just not enough, is all I'm telling you. It is not sufficient. And especially if you're just a hearer of what you're reading in the Scripture and not a doer. We need more time to hear from God, less time to demand of God. Our prayer lives are so given to demanding things of God that we have no time to actually hear from God. What would it mean for you to be serious about knowing God? Committing to the daily office where you pray several times throughout the day. And we talked about this. Pray more often. We need multiple meetings with God, not just one. Why? Because my car's out of alignment. It pulls off the road constantly. I need it to constantly be pulled back. Maybe it is a 30-minute devotional time. Maybe it's constantly reciting the gospel to yourself. Maybe it's being serious about finding the sacred pathways and pursuing it. So many things you could put in there. Maybe it's 20 minutes of just flat-out silence so that you can detox and hear from God. We need to be doers, not just hearers. If we just think, "Oh, wouldn't that be so good," then we'll never do it. What are some things you can put in that box as items to begin trying? The second thing we say was best is relationships. And far too often, we choose tasks over relationships. We make the same mistake that Martha made. We'd rather have a clean bathroom than a growing friendship, right? And I'm right there with you. Because in our minds, the growing friendship will end if they come see the dirty bathroom, right? But what we don't understand is that's got nothing to do with friendship, right? And that's a silly example to talk about, but we almost always choose tasks over relationships. And we say, "Oh man, it'd be so cool to spend time with you. Maybe we can catch up next week." And then you repeat the same refrain to them next week, and then the following week, and then the following week. See, what Martha missed out on wasn't just time with Jesus, it was time with others. We talked in Acts chapter 2 about this dynamic example of the early church, that they were meeting together not just for worship gatherings, but in each other's homes and throughout the day, that we need multiple meetings with people, multiple venues to meet with people, that just connecting with other believers on Sundays is not enough. It's not enough. I introduced you to a book called The Search to Belong by Joseph Myers, which is a great book. And he suggests, based on space theory, not aerospace, but like actual space, that we need to pursue belonging in four different quadrants of space. Public space, like that's like this right here. Social space, where we're with a bunch of people just having fun. Personal space, where we're beginning to share more life together. an intimate space where we're willing to bear our souls with a few people, you know? And we need more people. The bigger the space is, the more belonging we need, right? So think of it this way. Maybe these are just totally shooting from the hip, so don't take these down as truth. Maybe you need 32 relationships in public space and 16 in social and 4 in personal and 2 in intimate. Something like that, you know? Think of it like that. We have always believed in the church that we need to keep taking relationships to the next level. But the truth is, we need them at every level to really have the belonging that we need. So what are practical things that you can do to pursue relationships in public space? You know, one thing that should be in that box for you as part of your rhythm of life is that I will be in church on Sundays, you know, as often as I can. Not because it's a religious rite, not because God's only happy when you're here, but because, like, being together, there's something really important about that, you know? You can listen to a sermon on TV or on a podcast. It's not about the sermon. You can hear worship music other times, but there's something awesome about being together with our family when we're here together, you know? What does it mean to gather in social spaces, to have fun, to be with people? What are practical ways that you could gather in personal? Can I put a quick plug in for community groups? If you're not part of a community group, whether it's through Hope Alliance or through another network that you have, then you really need relationships on that personal level where people are willing to engage in your life and help you and care for you, and you can care for others. And what about intimate? You know? Is there one person that, man, if the two of you could just link arms, God could really do unbelievable spiritual things in your life? One of those better be your spouse if you're married. Right? We've talked about this before. It's not, honey, hey, I'll hang out with you in public space. I've got the boys down here. But probably need someone else, not just your spouse, you know? Maybe one or two people that, like, when you are, like, in the ditch, you're not embarrassed to say to them, dude, either I screwed up really bad or I'm really struggling. And they are the kind of person that doesn't judge you but jumps down in to help you. You know? We need that. It's not going to happen by autopilot. You've got to be intentional about this stuff. I often hear people often say, well, I would love to have these kind of things. And my next question is, well, what are you doing to pursue them? Well, no one has come and asked me. Well, gosh, I would love for everyone to come and ask me too, but sometimes you got to have the resolve to go to someone who maybe God is drawing you to say, you know what? I really could use something like this in my life. Would you help me? A couple of weeks ago, another pastor in our district came to me and did that very thing. I was blown away by his courage. You know what? It's my privilege to walk with him in that way. And I bet you find that from other folks too. Likewise, you need time with your family, right? Be intentional about time with your family, with your spouses, with your, you know, your extended family, whatever it is, with your good friends. And then rest. You must be intentional about your rest. We talked through Psalm 46 and said the psalmist gives this very simple statement, be still, and what happens when you're still? You know God, right? This is unbelievable, and yet we never take him up on it, you know? We do everything we can to know God, and the psalmist is like, well, if you just be still, you might have a better chance. So what would it mean for you to enter into times of tangible stillness? Practically, I suggested to you keeping Sabbath. For some people, you're going to be like, that's a little bit weird, I can't do it. This is not, you don't have to, I just think it's a gift from God. One that you could enter and be really blessed by it. But you ought to be having vacations. You better be taking days off that are really days off, not just days you don't go into the office. You know, you ought to be spending fun time with people, you know, just for pure fun and enjoyment. You ought to be getting the kind of sleep that you need. You ought to be eating healthy and exercising, so forth and so on, so that you are building in. Unless you are committed to this stuff, it's not going to happen, you know. That's why, you know, autopilot is why gym memberships go through the roof in January, and by February, the gyms are empty, you know. Right? Because we have great intentions, but we allow our lives to be driven by other things rather than this. And then the last thing is finances. We talked about this last week, and I'll just summarize this real quick. Unless you are intentional about your finances, you will simply spend money on what you buy. But the scriptures teach us a different way. It says, first and foremost, you ought to honor God with your money. There's no, let's eliminate the religiosity from this. No one is demanding a certain percentage. I think that's a little bit misunderstood. But you ought to, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, be very generous towards God with your money. You know? Some of us need to give beyond the tithe because God has been that generous to us. It's on the basis of the gospel. But more importantly, or equally as importantly, I should say, is you ought to not harvest your field all the way to the edges. And why? So that you can help people who are in need, is what the Old Testament says. What would it look like practically for you to say, I make $40,000 a year, and I'm going to live off of $30,000 a year so that I can honor God and support the movement of his kingdom with $7,000, I'm making up numbers, $7,000, and with $3,000 I'm going to set aside, and I'm just going to let it be there, and when God brings someone into my midst that is struggling and needs help, I can say yes to the best thing rather than saying yes to a new Xbox or 10 meals out at the Outback or whatever. You know, it does take sacrifice, and it's hard and it's difficult, and left to our own ways on autopilot, we'll have all the best intentions, and then we'll never do it. So, that was a hardcore review, fast-paced, but I want you to take this home and pray about it. Listen, if you're like, you know what, this whole rule of life thing, that sounds like, it sounds like where it came from, the desert fathers. It should go to the desert and drink no water and die, you know? Fine, I don't care. You don't have to use this. I just want you to be intentional, you know? And maybe you have a better way of doing it than this. That's fine. I'm just wanting to give you handles and tools so that you can be intentional. But what I'm going to do in this last minute is I want to be personal with you. And I'm going to read you mine so that you have an idea, right? Don't judge me. I'm not perfect. But don't also judge me and say, wow, he's spiritual. Because guess what? This all doesn't happen every time. And sometimes a lot of it doesn't happen. Here we go. My divine purpose is to glorify God by making disciples. My unique calling is to teach the gospel so it's real for people. That's what I feel like God has uniquely called me to do, especially for people who are religious people. So they've heard this before, but it's all been propositional. On the basis of God's love and my design, I use wisdom to choose what is best. Knowing God, I pray the daily office 3 times a day. I take the boys to school in the morning, I come home, I spend 30 minutes praying. And that prayer doesn't look like me going through a list, it looks like me taking a deep breath and saying, the day can wait for a minute, I'm going to start with God. And then I got to do it again at lunch because I've been working all morning and my day's gone way off the road, you know? And then I've got to do it before I go to bed because otherwise I'll go to bed with all the anxieties of the day. That's how I do it. You know, in my daily office isn't some lectionary, some semblance of readings. It's just times where I tell myself the gospel because I need to hear it a million times. 15 to 20 minutes of silence to listen. Because I hate silence, I found I need it. Because I there's constant noise in my life. So for 15 or 20 minutes, I go outside and walk just to be quiet. Scripture meditation. Every morning I've been reading through 1 Corinthians. I read it as part of that 30-minute time of listening, and then I try to bring it back constantly throughout the day. Rather than writing a sermon off what I've read, which is what I'm used to trying to do, right? Because that's what my vocation tells me to do. I try to hear, and I try to bring it back constantly. My sacred pathways, we talked about that book, are enthusiasts and intellectual. So I like when I'm together with a bunch of people singing or praising God, so I try to find that as much as I can, even if it means putting on a YouTube video of a live concert so I feel like there's other people with me, you know? You could show up at my house at 11 o'clock one morning, and it could be a crazy concert with a guy that doesn't sing very well singing leads, you know? But that helps me, you know? Because that's who I am. That's what I do. I got to be intentional about it. And intellectual, like I like reading about the Desert Fathers. You might think it's the most boring thing, but it actually helps me. You know, for some of you, you're naturalists. You got to go be in nature. For some of you, you're contemplatives. You need to deeply reflect on the truths of the gospel. You're traditionalists, liturgy and things like that. There's tons of ways. These are mine. And monthly, I take a half a day on a Friday, and I go be alone with God. Right? My job lets me do that. Yours might not, but I've got a cool job. Relationships. Public space, I'm committed to Sunday mornings. I better be, right? I'm committed to Sunday mornings. Social space, I do what it's called contacting. I try to get together with people as much as I can. It's my favorite part of my days, just hanging out with people. A personal space, I'm invested in the community group right now at the Young's House, helping them get that started. We're committed to that. We're part of that regularly. People are speaking into my life. I'm being honest with people that are part of that group, and I'm allowing them to be honest too. We're caring for each other. Intimate space, I've got intimate relationships with the leaders of this church. I've been honest with them. They've prayed over me for things that are difficult things in my life. I've prayed for healing in different ways. I've hopefully done the same for them. Obviously intimate with my wife, and she speaks the gospel to me so clearly. And then I've got a coach, Alan from the district, who I meet with once a month for him to speak into my life, not just as a church planter, but as a follower of Jesus. And these are commitments I've made. We take Friday night and we spend it together as a family, right? We don't break that up. And if we have to break it up, we give another day to it. I know we're going long, but my life is so interesting. I hope this is helpful. I'm committed to being involved in the lives of non-Christians. So I know my neighbors. I intentionally spend time with them. The boys' sports and activities. Rest, I do Sabbath. I do Sabbath from Sunday when we get done here until Monday at lunchtime. That's intentional rest for me. I take a day off on Monday and sometimes on Saturday. We're committed to an annual vacation. We did that for the first time in 5 years last year. It revolutionized my life. It kind of sounds silly, but like, if you don't write it down and be committed to it, you won't do it. Because all of a sudden it'll be June and you'll be like, well, what should we do? Well, we didn't save any money. Well, we can't do anything, you know? You know, and rest, here we go laugh again, but I love sports, right? Rest for me is sitting down and watching the Flyers beat the Rangers last night. It was fantastic. Finances. Listen, I'm not saying this to coerce you. I just want to be honest with you, right? Every month we give $600 to Hope Alliance Church. We just write it out. We just give it. It's gone. Sometimes I wish I had that money, but it's for God. I honor him with that. We send $50 to support a campus ministry on the College of Franklin and Marshall from a good friend of mine, Scott Evans, who does that. We send $35 a month to support a child in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. You know, all of these things are financially giving to God, right? Likewise, we set aside $20 a month. It's not a lot, but it's our edges, and it builds up. So we find people who are in need, and we bless them. You know, some of you have been recipients of that without you even knowing, because it doesn't need to know. You know, we can say yes because we do it. We use a monthly budget; otherwise, we spend tons of money, and we save for vacation. You see it? It's not hardcore, right? You just write down this so that you're sincere about pursuing these kinds of things. And then, guess what? In your community groups or in your intimate relationships, share these so that other people can speak into them. This is one tool. And if you hate the rule of life, I understand. But please be a doer, not just a hearer. Can I pray with you?